Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This week, federal election officials held a press conference to reassure voters their ballots will count. But doubts are surfacing. In state after state, lawsuits have been filed over voter registration problems. And then there are those so-called provisional ballots, more on those in a moment, including why they could be the hanging chad of 2004. Joining us on the line is Rob Ritchie. He's executive director of the Center for Voting and Democracy in Maryland. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Robin.
And there are concerns, as you know, about early voting, poll worker training, electronic voting machines. And now allegations have surfaced that contractors hired by the Republican Party to register voters in several states may have torn up the registrations of Democrats. Let's start there. The company in question is Sproul & Associates of Arizona. They were hired in other states to go out and collect registrations. A former employee this week alleged that the Democratic Party registrations were ripped up and thrown out. The company denies that. Oregon has opened a criminal investigation. First of all, is this illegal if a company is going door-to-door and registering voters and those voters think they're registered? Can they then destroy the registrations?
Well, there's a problematic part of this, which is that it's not the state directly registering people. It's often registrars or people who are out there trying to build a vote for their side. And they could easily say, oh, we meant to process those registrations, and it just didn't work out. I think it's going to be hard to prove that it was consciously done. Mm-hmm. And what's also true is that we don't have national laws governing this. It's a state and county matter, and some states and counties might be very unclear about their laws on this, and federal government doesn't really set clear standards for these kinds of things.
And we should say that there are Democratic-leaning organizations that go out and register voters, and while there have been no allegations that they've ripped up or destroyed any organization could knock on a door, ask which way you might be voting, and if you're saying the party you don't want, just walk away.
Exactly. No, that's done all the time, and most people out there doing voter registration are, particularly this year in the battleground states, are doing it with a partisan goal in mind, and they're not going to register or work hard to register someone they think is not going to vote for their preferred candidate.
No. Well, let's move to provisional ballots. These are cast by voters who turn up at the polls on election day, but their names don't show up on the registration lists, perhaps because, you know, the registration form was lost or for whatever reason. They use these provisional ballots. They vote. And then their registration gets vetted. In other words, the ballot is put aside and checked. So why is that turning out to be a possible problem?
One of the problems is that sometimes people go to the wrong polling place. Their polling place may have shifted. They may have moved a few blocks and didn't realize that was going to lead to a different polling place. Or sometimes they're actively misinformed in some of the, you know, tricks that we see in political campaigns. And if they're in the wrong polling place, think they should be able to cast a ballot and are given a provisional ballot, in some states, that ballot will count for president, and in other states, it won't. Yeah. And actually, federal courts right now are giving conflicting rulings about what should happen. It's one of the why it's heading to be the chad of 2004 is that it's very murky, and the litigation that will go with it could end up at the Supreme Court.
Right. Now, and to another issue, I understand that counties across the country are backlogged trying to process voter registrations in time for November 2nd. And might these be some of the people who show up and have to take a provisional ballot?
Exactly. No, it easily could happen, and we just haven't corrected some of the big things that we should have in the wake of 2000, and voter registration is one of the big ones.
Yeah. So Rob Ritchie of the Center for Voting and Democracy, it sounds one thing I'm hearing is if you think that somebody else registered you to vote, you might want to check before election day.
Absolutely, should check, yes.
To make sure. And how else do you think it's going to go on November 2nd? What are you anticipating?
I think that it is going to be close right now. I mean, the national polls indicate that, and that if it's close, we will have a repeat of 2000, and both sides are all prepped and ready to fight in the court. So we're going to see a highly controversial election, I think. And what I hope, the only positive outcome perhaps that could come out of this, is that we really take on the problems in our voting process, which we haven't done yet. We are a nation where we all care about who gets elected, and right now we give too much deference to states, and then states typically then defer it down to counties, and it just leads to a lot of a lot of uncertainty, and we simply can't handle a close election.
Rob Ritchie, Executive Director of the Center for Voting and Democracy in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Rob, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to the election as seen through the media filter. The Federal Communications Commission says it will not stop the Sinclair Broadcasting Company from airing a documentary that is highly critical of Senator John Kerry. The company plans to broadcast the documentary Stolen Honor, Wounds That Never Heal on its 62 stations over the next 2 weeks. The film chronicles Kerry's 1971 testimony before Congress and features highly charged interviews with Vietnam veterans and their families. Here's a clip.
I knew he was getting publicity, but I didn't believe that the American people were going to fall for what he was saying. They couldn't. They had sons, brothers, husbands over there fighting. They were war criminals coming back? They weren't. They were good men who, because of Kerry's testimony later, came back, spat upon. They couldn't even wear their uniforms in the streets.
The Democratic National Committee has filed a complaint with the Federal Election Commission on the grounds that airing this program would amount to an illegal campaign contribution. Here's Democratic National Committee lawyer Joseph Sandler.
This is the first time in the history of the Democratic Party that we have ever filed a complaint under campaign finance laws against a media outlet. It's an extraordinary, exceptional thing to do.
Meanwhile, Sinclair Broadcasting says it will present the documentary as part of a commentary segment. Well, we have two media critics joining us to discuss this and other media issues in the campaign, David Shaw from the Los Angeles Times and David Folkenflik of the Baltimore Sun. And David Shaw, I want to start with you first. What do you think of Sinclair's decision to air the documentary?
Well, it's a rotten decision. I mean, I'd feel that way if they had announced or some other broadcast group had announced they were going to show Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 in the days before the election. There's no way either of those could be construed as a news story. There's certainly nothing new in Kerry's testimony in 1971 before Congress. It seems to be a blatant attempt to influence voters, and one that if we had a legitimate fairness doctrine, wouldn't be permitted.
Well, and David Folkenflik, remind us, but what is the legality of this? Because Sinclair does own some stations that carry the major networks, and those major networks have said that it's perfectly legal for them to block programming to put this film on.
What they're doing is they own or control 62 stations across the country, and they have affiliations with all of the networks, the big three, as well as UPN and the WB and Fox. And they're devoting a primetime programming, at least an hour, on one of several nights, just a couple short weeks before the election, to a program that they claim is still evolving. It's based largely on this documentary, Stolen Honor. The legality is that there aren't a lot of current federal regulations and laws that prohibit Sinclair from doing this.
Now, I had understood that federal election law does prohibit public corporations and labor unions from airing electioneering communications 60 days before an election.
Well, Sinclair is having it a little bit both ways in that they are saying, listen, this is a legitimate journalistic operation, just like an op-ed piece or a news report. They're presenting it, they say, under the rubric of commentary. They have a nightly conservative commentary done by a corporate vice president named Mark Hyman, who does it. Actually, it's here just outside of Baltimore, their corporate headquarters, and it gets put on all 62 stations every single day. You know, the Democrats say, you know, this is different. This is not a legitimate journalistic operation. And they use the sort of checkered past of the journalist responsible for the documentary as justification. He's a Pulitzer winner, but he's also a guy who was fired for controversial stories about the Vietnam War Memorial back in the mid to early 80s.
And he has, some would say, he has some ties with the Republican Party. He worked with Tom Ridge, although we do know him as a real journalist. Carlton Sherwood, who made this film, actually worked at a television station here in Boston. But David Shaw, I want to ask you, tell me more about Sinclair, because isn't this the same company that didn't air a Nightline?
Yeah, when Nightline was running a roll call of all the people who had died in Iraq, they ordered their stations not to run that because they considered that to be taking a political side of an issue. This certainly makes their current position stupefyingly hypocritical, but we should not be shocked by hypocrisy in politics.
In addition, I mean, it's worth adding, this is Dave Folkenflik in Baltimore, since 9/11, the station's management has become more and more explicit about their conservatism. They ran editorials right after the attacks announcing support for the response by the Bush administration explicitly, and ordered their local anchors to do this. This caused a lot of concern, particularly at the local Fox station, which is the Sinclair flagship.
You're saying that Sinclair ordered its local anchors to read statements supporting the Bush administration's war?
Supporting the Bush administration's response to the terrorist attacks in September 2001. They said Sinclair Company and this station stands behind President Bush in support of his response to the terrorist strikes and the war on terror. This was in the days and just even the first week after the attacks. I mean, there were a lot of patriotic responses by the media. You know, you remember the sort of waving flags incorporated on all of the on all of the cable news stations. But this was as strong and as explicit as anything I had seen anywhere. It's one of a series of things, including significant campaign contribution to Republican candidates and causes. They sent a news crew to Iraq because they declared ahead of time. The mainstream news media is intentionally overlooking good news stories from Iraq. They sent both this editorialist and a reporter abroad in the early part of this year to find those untold stories, they said.
This is David Shaw in Los Angeles. I was just going to point out that they were also one of the groups of stations that when Bill Maher made a few controversial remarks in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, they pulled his show Politically Incorrect off the stations that ran that Sinclair owned. And Sinclair has also been one of the leaders in the drive to loosen regulations on television. And clearly one of the reasons they want that is so they can do this precisely this kind of thing.
Doesn't he have a right in a company that he owns to speak his piece in a commentary?
The reason that we had a fairness doctrine and the reason we have an FCC to begin with is because the feeling is that the public airways are just that, the public airways, and they ought not to be abused. That it's a little bit different than owning a newspaper or owning a magazine, which people can choose or not to choose to have come into its house. I mean, the public airways are supposed to be, and should be, at least in my view, monitored in a way that keep them reasonably fair-minded. Now, that idea has gone completely by the board and sounds almost anachronistic these days. To be able to broadcast in primetime something that is blatantly propagandistic is not what is best for the American political system. I mean, I've written several columns complaining about the attention that the media is paying to the entire question of what either John Kerry or George Bush did during the Vietnam War. I don't care about Bush's National Guard service, and I don't care about Kerry's either his medal-winning heroism in Vietnam or his anti-war statements afterward.
David Folkenflik, you're the closest to the home office of this company. Do you think that they're going to go ahead and do it?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about it. There's nothing exactly cloaked about what Sinclair is doing here. They see this as good branding, among other things, because they think it'll differentiate themselves from the mainstream, more muddled, centrist presentations of network news programming.
Media critic David Folkenflik of the Baltimore Sun and David Shaw of the L.A. Times. We contacted Sinclair Broadcasting Media, by the way, but we received no response from them. Well, when we come back, more on the media. What about that ABC News internal memo? Is it anti-Bush or just standard procedure in shaping news coverage? Stay with us. There's much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today we've been talking with media critics David Folkenflik of the Baltimore Sun and David Shaw of the Los Angeles Times about the presidential campaign as seen through the media filter. Well, this week, ABC News political director Mark Halperin has come under fire for a memo he wrote to his staff. Some say it's a mandate to go easy on John Kerry. The memo was written on October 8th, and first off, I'll read an excerpt. He writes, "The New York Times and Howard Fineman on the web both make the same point today. The current Bush attacks on Kerry involve distortions and taking things out of context in a way that goes beyond what Kerry has done. Kerry distorts, takes out of context, and mistakes all the time, but these are not central to his efforts to win. We have a responsibility to hold both sides accountable to the public interest, but that doesn't mean we reflexively and artificially hold both sides equally accountable when the facts don't warrant that." Well, the memo goes on to say, of course, it's up to Kerry to defend himself. Well, the network, ABC, says it stands by Mark Halperin, and they note he has worked closely with Republicans and Democrats over the years, and both sides have found him to be fair. Well, David Shaw, first to you. I want to ask you your reaction to the memo.
Well, I think it's a badly worded memo. I can't read Mark Halperin's mind. I've interviewed him in the past and found him to be a thoughtful and intelligent, and I did not think a biased observer or a biased journalist. But certainly the wording of that memo, it seems to me, is at very best unfortunate. I mean, I do think that one of the problems in this campaign in particular has been the tendency of journalists to practice, you know, what others have called he said, she said, we're mum journalism, and to give equal weight to both sides, even when one side is utterly outlandish. I mean, the Swift Boat veterans being an example, that there was plenty of documentary evidence to refute what the Swift Boat veterans were saying. But the way that was phrased, I think he had to couch it more carefully and say you shouldn't give equal weight when the facts are not equal.
David Falkenflik, some people are surprised that there is any direction coming to reporters, but is this common?
Yeah, it is. You know, there was last year a guy by the name of Charlie Renna, a former Fox News reporter, or producer, I should say, had saved some memos from a senior executive there in service of his contention that there was a kind of conservative pro-Bush line being peddled. And indeed, some of those came out in the OutFox documentary that was released earlier this year. Look, I didn't have such a problem even with the wording of what was said here. I mean, this was an internal memo. I do think if they want to say that the kinds of distortions done by President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and their aides are, you know, of a magnitude different than those by their counterparts in the Kerry camp, they've got to be really transparent about showing what they're basing that on.
David Shaw, the problem with something like this being leaked as well is that selected parts of it are being leaked. For instance, the line, it's up to Kerry to defend himself. We're not hearing that.
Well, it seems to me that one of the problems these days with the Internet is that anybody who puts anything in writing or in a memo is taking a huge risk. You have to assume that anything that you write is going to find its way into the blogosphere or somewhere out there into the Internet. And I think that then it behooves everyone to ignore the difference between the personal and the professional and figure that any communication that you send could find its way out there. And therefore, if you're going to commit it to writing as opposed to just telling somebody face-to-face, be very careful of the language you use, because you're right, it will be excerpted. The stuff that makes you look bad will be emphasized, and the stuff that is more balancing will be left out.
David Falkenflik at the Baltimore Sun, before we let you both go, we want to touch on just a couple of other media items both you've written about. First of all, David Brock, head of the liberal group Media Matters for America, called on MSNBC to dump their pollster because of his Republican ties in the past. Tell us more about Frank Luntz and MSNBC.
Frank Luntz is a he's sort of a public opinion gauger, if you will, and what he's most renowned for are certain kinds of focus groups. He came up as sort of the wunderkind for the Republicans as part of their takeover of the House of Representatives in 1994. He worked with Newt Gingrich on certain kinds of phrase words and coded language to use for candidates to try to denigrate their opponents, and it was almost like a tip sheet for candidates to mimic and mimeograph for across the country. It seemed to work pretty well. You know, he says, well, I've really gotten out of the political business. You can find records showing in David's state of California that he was doing political activity as recently as last year on the recall election and for Bill Simon's gubernatorial efforts in 2002. So he still seems to have a strong Republican involvement. You know, there are those who say that Frank's testing hasn't come out uniformly in favor of Republicans, and that may well be true. He hadn't been labeled as a guy with a partisan affiliation. And I think more than anything, this speaks to how thin the membrane is between the political establishment and the media covering it.
And then there's Farnaz Fasihi, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal based in Iraq, who sent an email to a group of friends who then sent it to their friends. I know I got one. Pretty much she was talking about the deteriorating situation in Iraq. Was she, David, pulled from coverage of Iraq?
Well, she was, but she said, and the Wall Street Journal said, as I recall, that this was a long-planned vacation from her, that she followed the normal rotation. They would have brought her home anyway, and there's been no discussion about what will happen with her after her vacation. I mean, but it does get back to this, what we talked about just a few moments ago, Robin, which is that you really are taking a risk when you send emails out now. I mean, much of what she said in there, other reporters in Iraq have echoed and would fit very well in a reporter's notebook. Some of the more political observations about President Bush himself you know, would not fit into that kind of reportage, and she took a chance by including it in a personal email to her friends. It's unfortunate. You ought to be able to have that kind of personal communication, but the way things are nowadays, you can't.
David Shaw, I just want to ask, when you say the way things are nowadays, do you mean as well the fact that everybody is finger-pointing at everybody else for having partisanship, and you just can't have any appearance of that?
Yes, certainly the polarization of society and the accusation ongoing of media bias makes it even worse. But I think that even if you didn't have that polarization, the availability of the Internet and the possibility that anything you say can be circulated to people who might wish you harm has to make everybody a little bit cautious about what they write.
David Shaw from the Los Angeles Times, David Folkenflik of the Baltimore Sun, thank you both for talking to us about the media matters in this campaign.
Thank you, Robin.
You bet.
And by the way, earlier we spoke with both Davids about Sinclair Broadcasting, which is airing an anti-Kerry documentary on its 62 stations in the next 2 weeks. A lawyer for the Kerry campaign is now demanding equal time on each Sinclair station airing that film. Stay tuned. And also stay tuned because next week here on Here and Now, we'll speak to a retired state trooper from Massachusetts who spent a year training Iraqi police in Baghdad. But for now, there's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. What is precious to you? Composer Michael Moss and visual artist Claudio Ravaschier asked their neighbors that question, many of them Boston artists. Their answers ranged from the concrete.
My hands are precious to me.
To the abstract.
My integrity is precious to me.
The responses are featured in a sound art installation called Precious, and the exhibit opens this week and when artists in Boston's Four Point Channel neighborhood open their studios to the public. But Here and Now's Sean Cole has a preview.
Claudia Ravaschier, Michael Moss, and I descend into the basement of 27 Melcher Street in South Boston, right over the bridge from South Station.
Here we are.
It's really basement-y down here. Paint is peeling off the brick walls. Water trickles through pipes overhead. But in the middle of the room are six long curtains made of fake gold chains, like beaded curtains from the 70s. Almost without a word, the two artists leave my side and approach the curtains, triggering colored floodlights overhead. They stroke the chains as though they were playing a harp. And for a moment, I think there's a fourth person down here with us.
My musical instruments are precious to me.
And then a fifth person, and a sixth, and... Well, listen.
My dog's ballot.
Democratic leadership is precious to me.
My dog's ballot.
My integrity is precious.
My hands are precious.
And my heart is precious. And my heart is precious.
There's speakers on each area of chain. So if you come through, you sort of hear the sound change as you move through the installation.
The chains are attached to switches, which are attached to wires, which are attached to a computer that's playing these sound bites, along with the musical accompaniment Michael composed. It's kind of an engineering marvel.
A third of a mile of gold chain is what we have here.
A third of a mile of gold chain.
It's a third of a mile of gold chain. And when the UPS man came with the packages, it's 130 pounds of gold chain. I never thought I would we'd be receiving a package like that.
My dog, Bella, is precious.
But the chief materials of this piece, which again is called Precious, are the voices of Michael and Claudia's neighbors, whom Michael went around interviewing about a month ago.
My dog, Bella.
What's most precious to me, people's relationships with themselves, their bodies.
Michael says some of the responses were surprising.
We thought that the children would all pick possessions, and one of them picked their family.
My family is precious to me.
Which was gratifying. I thought that most grown-ups would pick something emotional, but some of them did pick either places or things. But those places or things all sort of had to do with emotions, like
Fenway Park is precious,
or musical instruments.
He had one response that says, I think it's on this beam, my country with a democratic
America
leadership.
With a democratic leadership is precious to me.
You know, it's interesting because you don't know what's precious to somebody else, and I think people don't know what's precious to them all the time. You know, it sort of takes some searching. Because I have to say, I would have trouble coming up with something that's completely and totally precious to me if I had to pick just one thing. And if I thought that somebody was recording that, it might be harder for me to say.
Well, I'm recording.
Oh, no.
What's precious to you?
What is precious to me? That's a good question. I had to think about it long and hard, and I think it was probably my relationship with my father, but didn't realize that until, you know, after he was had passed away.
The death of Claudia's father is partly what inspired Precious.
I was thinking about what do people leave behind, and people always think in terms of possessions, but that isn't really what we leave behind, not truly. And I think that's how it began to grow.
The dangling chains idea came out of something precious from Michael's childhood.
When I was a kid, I had been like fascinated with my uncle's cuckoo clock. You know, when you pick the chain up in your hand and it gets heavier and heavier. And I used to, I guess I spent a number of hours doing that while visiting his house. And it just was a fond childhood memory. So, you know, we just started talking about what do these symbols mean. You know, things like chain and possessions and jewelry, and can those things, you know, replace feelings in your heart, or are they just symbols of emotions?
My cat's whiskers, when they fall to the floor, they're precious to me, and I put them in a box.
But when asked his own question, point blank, Michael doesn't say, my uncle's cuckoo clock is precious to me. Funnily enough, he doesn't know what to say.
I don't know that I could pick one thing. That's, I guess, my problem.
After asking 20 people.
Yeah.
Yeah, too. Sean just made me do it.
One thing. Well, you know, it's the total picture of my life with my family and my music and my friends.
That's too much.
Yeah, I was going to say, if Michael Moss comes up to you, Michael Moss, and says, I need you to pick one thing and say, you know, whatever it is precious to me.
My family is precious to me, I guess. It's too hard to say, like I say. It's the total picture. I would have been a bad respondent to my own interview.
My husband is very, very precious to me.
Michael and Claudia say some of the people they approached didn't want to participate, didn't want to talk about what's precious to them.
I don't know what's precious to me.
It's like the question hit too close to home, and Claudia says she knows how they feel.
My son asked me if he was precious to me, and I have to say I was at a loss for words. I didn't want to say. I just looked at him and I said, well, many people are precious to me. And, you know, it wasn't really what I felt. I wanted to say, yes, of course, you're so precious to me, but almost feels a little jinxing. You know, you don't want to have to name something as so precious, because I think if you do name something as so precious, you can feel that, you know, it could be lost. Maybe that's just me being neurotic.
Claudia's son is precious to Michael as well. In fact, Claudia's son is Michael's son. In November, Claudia and Michael will have been married 16 years.
I don't know if it's precious to me.
My cat's whiskers, when they fall to the floor.
That report from Sean Cole. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. And this news note on the subject of things precious. Today, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan is weighing in on the high price of oil. He says this year's surge in energy prices is likely to have far less of an effect on the economy than the oil shocks of the 1970s. Greenspan predicted that the global economy will adjust to a recent spike in the cost of oil. but he isn't ruling out the unexpected. Oil prices closed at a record $54.76 per barrel yesterday. Ahead on Here and Now, we're going to review the new play from August Wilson, Gem of the Ocean. You are listening to Here and Now. The British newspaper The Guardian has started a campaign urging its readers to write to undecided voters in Clark County, Ohio, to tell them to vote in the presidential election. And while they don't say so explicitly, it's assumed that the left-leaning paper wants Clark County voters to support John Kerry. Michelle Everhart has been reporting on this story for her paper, the Springfield News Sun in Clark County. And Michelle, I know you spoke to The Guardian features editor Ian Katz in London, but what exactly are they asking their readers to do?
Well, they are having their readers send a personal letter to one unaffiliated voter here in Clark County, telling them that this election affects more than just Americans, that this has the potential of impacting the entire world.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like they have a kit prepared for their readers at The Guardian, how you would do it. It goes further, how you could possibly donate money to the campaigns legally. But let's concentrate on this letter-writing campaign. First of all, how'd they get the names of the undecided, undeclared voters in Clark County?
Well, because the voter rolls are public record, they just paid a $25 fee to get what's called a flat file, and the Board of Elections here sent a disc over with every registered voter in Clark County, and they took from that I think they said 36,000 different names of unaffiliated voters, and it just has the person's name and their address, and that's how the readers receive the information.
Now, how do they prevent, let's say, one undeclared, poor undeclared voter in Clark County, Ohio, getting thousands of letters from around the world?
Well, they said that they developed a system so that each name is only given out once. Once it's given to someone, it is crossed off. They've asked the readers not to share that information with anyone. So they're trying to ensure a system where the people of Clark County are not inundated with letters from all over the world.
Now, why Clark County, Ohio?
We are a pretty pivotal county and a pivotal state. In the last presidential election, Al Gore beat George Bush by, I think, 324 votes. Mm-hmm. And we've had a lot of national media. We've had a lot of tension from both the presidential candidates. We've had two visits from Kerry, one visit from President Bush. So, and it's a pretty split county. We really are a microcosm of the whole nation.
Right. The Guardian writes that Clark County, Ohio, is balanced on a razor's edge between Republicans and Democrats. Well, they also anticipate in The Guardian that this might be counterproductive, that Americans might see this as interference. And now you've been writing about this. How are people who live in Clark County feeling about this?
Some of the people I've talked to think that they agree that it could be counterproductive. I've talked to one man who thinks it's unethical. I talked to another woman who's originally from England, who has lived in the United States for 50 years, and said that she cannot believe that people would actually feel that it is their right to tell us how to vote. Mm-hmm. So I honestly have not talked to anyone who thinks that this is going to work. I think that people are going to maybe just read the letter and throw it away. I don't think it's going to really influence anyone's vote.
In fact, someone told you, we already fought the revolution.
Right. That seems to be the sentiment that the Board of Elections is hearing.
Well, there could be some pen pal relationships that come out of it. But there's going to be more than that. We understand The Guardian is running this almost like a contest.
Yes. The last week in October, and possibly even sooner, they're going to send four of their most persuasive letter writers to Clark County, along with a couple of reporters and an editor, to do a little campaigning on their own and some publicity. So we're going to be invaded by the British here in Clark County, and I'm not sure how well the citizens here are going to react to that, so it'll be interesting to see.
Have you talked to anyone from the Kerry campaign, and are they worried about a backlash?
No, I talked to the Democratic chairman here in Clark County, and he said that he doesn't really think it's going to have that much impact. That, you know, it has the potential of angering people, but he thinks that people's minds are made up and that people aren't going to view this too negatively.
Yeah. I feel so sorry for these undecided enclaves like yours. I mean, it's been dangerous to turn on the television, and now you can't go near the mailbox.
Yes. And the Democratic campaign or Democratic chairman here in Clark County also said that that might be part of the problem, is that people are so inundated with, you know, ads on television and all the letters that they're receiving, you know, the mass letters and now these personal letters, that it's kind of much for the voters.
Right. Michelle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Michelle Everhart, reporter for the Springfield News Sun in tiny Clark County, Ohio. Stay with us. More ahead. Here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air a few of your thoughts, many of which came after yesterday's post-presidential debate roundup. A woman from Columbus, Ohio, told us she was outraged at John Kerry's outing of Dick Cheney's lesbian daughter when Kerry said that Cheney's daughter was an example of someone who didn't think homosexuality was a choice. Well, we questioned the term outing, since Mary Cheney is already out as a lesbian and her dad has spoken of her publicly. Jonathan Dreyer of Lexington, Massachusetts writes, "There's a simple reason so many people call Kerry's comment about Cheney's already openly gay daughter an outing. Panelist Morton Kondracki called Kerry's comment an outing on Fox News a few minutes after the debate. Apparently, that blatant lie was accepted as gospel truth by many listeners." Yesterday, we also reviewed the upcoming Masterpiece Theater production, The Lost Prince. It tells the true story of the young royal who was sent away at the turn of the century because he had, as we said, epileptic fits. Well, a listener who wanted to remain nameless wrote to say, "Epileptic fits is an archaic and offensive expression. It's better to just say epilepsy. The more extreme language is one of the things that supports discrimination, particularly in employment. The shame and ignorance that characterized the royal's attitude still persists." And finally, Carolyn McCabe wrote about the larger-than-normal squirrel population. She says, "Driving to work 2 weeks ago, I thought I was having some sort of nightmare. At one intersection, more than 50 squirrels, I counted them, were squished. Saddened, I marveled and wondered what on earth propelled them to their deaths." Well, Caroline, as we found out yesterday, last year's bumper crop of acorns led to fat and happy and reproductive squirrels. Their offspring have been running around like crazy looking for food this year. What can you do? Teenagers. Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright August Wilson has almost accomplished his epic mission to complete 10 plays chronicling the African-American experience through each decade of the 1900s. Fences takes place in the 50s, Joe Turner's Come and Gone is set in the teens, and The Piano Lesson in the 1930s. Here's a clip from the film version of that play.
"You never find you another piano like that."
"Yeah, that looks real nice."
"I told you."
"Mm-hmm.
You see how it's polished?"
"Mm-hmm.
My mama used to polish it every day."
"Yeah, that's real, man."
"I told you."
Now, August Wilson's new work, Gem of the Ocean, is set to open on Broadway next month, the ninth of this 10-play cycle. It's now on its final stop before Broadway, on stage at the Huntington Theater in Boston. And recently, Here and Now theater critic Bill Marks attended a performance, and he joins us in the studio with a report. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Robin.
Gem of the Ocean, the ninth of a 10-play cycle chronicling the African-American experience. Before we talk about this one, remind us of the others.
I would say that some of the best-known plays by Wilson would be Fences, of course, which is an intense father-son conflict that takes place in the 1950s. The Piano Lesson was broadcast on cable, and so a lot of people saw that, and it deals with the African-American heritage as embodied in an antique piano that a brother and sister are fighting over. And Joe Turner's Come and Gone is set in 1911, is probably one of his most intense plays in dealing with the legacy of slavery. slavery.
Right. Is there a thread through them other than the African-American experience?
There are a number of threads. There's Wilson's particular playwriting experience or his technique, which tends to be sort of an interesting combination of African sort of storytelling techniques and the sort of conventional well-made play that you see in something like Fences. Right. There's Aunt Esther. She's a difficult woman to kill, so she lasts for quite a long time in the series.
Well, in fact, let's talk about the new play, Gem of the Ocean, because she must be very difficult to kill off as a character, because in this play, she's now 285 years old.
She's 285 and kicking. Boy, is she kicking. And I believe this is the first time we actually meet Aunt Esther. She's mentioned in the other plays. Certainly, this is her biggest role. And it's 1904. The legacy of slavery is very much alive, meaning we have both Aunt Esther and another character in the play are former slaves. The play is set in Pittsburgh, like all of another thread in Wilson's plays. It's set there. And here, I think Wilson is dealing with, I don't want to say the beneficial aspect of slavery, but certainly the memory of slavery is something which, in a sense, creates a moral temperament in people, is very much what he's interested in. In this case, Aunt Esther, at 285 and kicking, is confronted with a young man called Citizen Barlow, who has inadvertently killed another man. Now, Esther is known throughout the community as a soul cleaner, someone who can sort of cleanse someone of feelings of guilt and sin. And in this scene, you have Esther talking to Barlow, who is asking her to do something to help him clean his soul.
And should we say Felicia Rashad plays Aunt Esther?
And Citizen Barlow, played by John Earl Jelks.
What's your name? My name is Esther Dye. Some people call me Aunt Esther. What do they call you?
Citizen. They call me Citizen Barlow.
Was you looking for money, Mr. Citizen? I'd give you $2 if I had my purse. Well, you can go in that room there and bring in my purse, and I'll give you $2. In that room there on the next day, you can go get it, and I'll give you $2.
I ain't looking for no money. I ain't no robber. I come to see you.
A scene from August Wilson's new play, Gem of the Ocean, and Felicia Rashad back on the board. She was on Broadway earlier this year.
In Raisin in the Sun, when she won a Tony Award for that.
And tell us more about not just Aunt Esther, but how she plays her.
Well, I have to admit that for me, I mean, certainly Felicia Rashad is a very talented actress, and I enjoy seeing her. My feeling about the portrait is that if I was 285 years old, I'd be pretty damn cranky. And the problem with her portrayal, I think, is that she plays it with an enormous amount of emotional strength. She's extremely sympathetic and likable. I mean, this sort of a crabby old woman, but boy, you just want to hug her over and over again. But I'm not quite sure that does justice to the role. I think there should be a roughness to her. And I'm not sure Rashad gives that in this role particularly. In other words, the idea that this is someone that's to say the least, a survivor. And one doesn't get that impression. And I also should say that a lot of other critics liked her portrait a lot more than mine. So I'm in the minority in this case.
Okay. Well, but it is a work in progress. It's moving to Broadway. Your thoughts on the play overall?
My thoughts on the play overall is that I have my favorites in the series. Joe Turner's Come and Gone is a favorite. Fences is a favorite. And also I like The Piano Lesson. I would say this falls in the latter bottom half, frankly, of the plays that we've seen so far. My feeling about it is that his best plays have a very intense conflict at the center of them, often between generations. In Fences, it was memorably between father and son. The problem with Gem of the Ocean for me is that there is no such strong conflict going on.
But would you say that it's a must-see at any rate for people who are following August Wilson's cycle?
For anyone following Wilson's work, of course, you would want to see this play. I mean, this is the beginning. This is 1904. He's bookended the 10-play series. In other words, the ninth play is now the first play chronologically, and he's going to be moving to the final play set in the 90s in April 2005. And so in that way, of course, you're going to want to see where it all starts, and you're, of course, going to want to see where it all ends. I must admit, I want to see the last play before I sort of come to the idea, well, what is the overarching theme? I mean, I've kept asking myself throughout the series and all the plays, the good ones and the ones not so good, are these tragedies? Are these comedies? Are these melodramas? And ultimately, is the entire series a tragic reflection of Black experience in America in the last century, or is it a positive? Or is it some sort of a tragicomic mix? We're going to have to wait till the last one to see. Certainly, Gem of the Ocean is much more comic in the sense that it's healing, rather than tragic.
And when does the 10th come out?
That will be coming out in April 2005, next year, and it's August. I assume he's already written it. At least he's got the title, Radio Golf, and that's going to be at the Yale Rep in New Haven.
Here now is theater critic Bill Marks. Bill, thank you.
Thank you.
For more information on August Wilson and the new work, Gem of the Ocean, go to our website, here-now.org. And Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.